With a career spanning 6 decades, George Takei is known around the world for his founding role in the acclaimed television series Star Trek, in which he played Hikaru Sulu, helmsman of the Starship Enterprise. But Takei's story goes where few stories have gone before. From a childhood spent in a Japanese-American internment camp on U.S. soil during World War II, to becoming one of the country's leading figures in the fight for LGBTQ rights, marriage equality, and social justice, George Takei is a powerful voice on issues ranging from politics to pop culture. Mashable.com named Takei the number one most influential person on Facebook. He currently boasts more than 10 million Facebook likes and 3 million Twitter followers, and he uses these platforms to share humor, news, and his take on current events. Takei hosts the AARP-produced YouTube series, Takei's Take, exploring the world of technology, trends, current events, and pop culture, and is the subject of the documentary To Be Takei. On his own YouTube channel, Takei and his husband, Brad Takei, bring viewers into their personal lives in the heightened reality web series, It Takei's Two. He was a series regular in the second season of Ridley Scott's anthology drama, The Terror Infamy, which premiered on AMC in August 2019. Takei is the author of 5 books, including his autobiography, To the Stars. His most recent book, the New York Times bestselling graphic memoir, They Called Us Enemy, was released in July 2019. Takei has served as the spokesperson for the Human Rights Campaign's Coming Out Project and was cultural affairs chairman of the Japanese American Citizens League. He is also chairman emeritus and a trustee of the Japanese American National Museum. He was appointed to the Japan-U.S. Friendship Commission by former President Clinton, and the government of Japan awarded Takei the Order of the Rising Sun Gold Rays with Rosette for his contribution to U.S.-Japanese relations. I am so happy and honored to introduce the VMware family to George Takei and to welcome George Takei to the VMware family.
Well, thank you very much, Megan, for that very comprehensive introduction. And it's good to be with the VMware family to share the morning with you. I'd like to talk about what it means to be an American. It's just one story. As we all know, there are 330 million stories collectively, but each one contributes to telling that story of being an American. When I was 5 years old, I was classified by my own country as an enemy alien. But I was neither. I wasn't an enemy. I was a five-year-old kid, and I wasn't an alien. I was born in Los Angeles, California, an American. My mother was born in Sacramento, California, an American. My father was born in Japan, but his mother passed when he was a young boy, and his widower father, my grandfather, decided to immigrate to the United States. And so he came to San Francisco with my father, who was a little boy. And he was educated, reared as a San Franciscan, and he always considered himself a San Franciscan. And yet we became enemy aliens because of the bombing of Pearl Harbor. We looked exactly like the people who bombed that harbor in Hawaii. We were every Japanese American throughout the country was classified as an enemy alien. And this hysteria mixed with racism swept throughout the country. Every elected official from city councils to state legislature to the Congress resonated with the ugly words of hate and accusing us of being a threat to national security. And the President of the United States got swept up in that toxic rhetoric. And on February 19th, 1942, he signed Executive Order 9066, which ordered all Japanese Americans on the West Coast, approximately 120,000 of us, to be summarily rounded up with no charges, no trial. Due process, a central pillar of our justice system, simply disappeared. We were to be rounded up and imprisoned in 10 barbed wire prison camps in 10 of the most desolate and hell-forsaken, God-forsaken places in the country. There were two in the swamps of Arkansas, There were two on the blistering hot desert of Arizona. There were camps on the windswept high plains of Wyoming, Idaho, Utah, Colorado, and two of the most desolate places in California. All this was going on around me, but I was too young to understand any of it. But there is one morning that I can never forget. The terror of that morning is embedded in my mind. That morning, my parents got me up very early, together with my brother Henry, a year younger, and my baby sister Nancy, who was still an infant. They dressed us hurriedly, and my brother and I were told to wait in the living room. So we were standing by the front window, just gazing out at the neighborhood. And suddenly, we saw two soldiers marching up our driveway. They carried rifles with shiny bayonets on them. They stomped up the porch and with their fists began pounding on the front door. The walls of the house seemed to tremble. My father came rushing out of the bedroom and answered the door. And literally at gunpoint, we were ordered out of our home. My father gave my brother and me little packages to carry, and he hefted two heavy suitcases, and we followed him out onto the driveway, and we stood there waiting for our mother to come out. And when she finally emerged from the house, she had our baby sister in one arm, a huge duffel bag in the other, and tears were streaming down her cheeks. It was a terrifying morning that I can never forget. We were loaded onto trucks with other Japanese American families that were gathered and driven out to Santa Anita Racetrack, where we were unloaded and herded over to the stable area. And there, each family was assigned one horse stall that still was pungent with the stink of horse manure. From a two-bedroom home on Garnet Street in Los Angeles to a smelly horse stall. This was to be our temporary home while the camps were being built. And when the construction of the camps was completed, we were loaded onto trains with hard wooden seats, with soldiers guarding both ends of each car, and transported two-thirds of the way across the country, three days and two nights, to the swamps of southeastern Arkansas. I will never be able to forget the barbed wire fence that confined us, the tall sentry towers with the machine guns pointed down at us. Searchlights followed me when I made the night runs from our barrack to the latrine. But to five-year-old me, I thought it was nice that they lit the way for me to pee. An innocent kid with no comprehension of what was going on. But children are amazingly adaptable. What would have been grotesquely abnormal became routine in my life. It became routine to line up three times a day to eat lousy food in a noisy mess hall. It became normal for me to go with my brother and I to go with our father to bathe in a mass shower. And it became normal to go to school in a black tar paper barrack and begin the school day with the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. I could see the barbed wire fence and the sentry tower right outside my schoolhouse window as I recited the words, "With liberty and justice for all." Too innocent to understand the irony in those words. A year into imprisonment, the government realized that there was a wartime manpower shortage. And here were all these young people that they could have had, that they had categorized as enemy alien. How to draft enemy aliens out of a prison camp to fight for this country? And the other irony is that many of the young people, thousands of young people, immediately after Pearl Harbor had rushed to the recruitment centers to volunteer to serve in the U.S. Army. This was an act of patriotism, which was answered with a slap on the face. They were denied military service and categorized as enemy alien. And now they needed us. Their dilemma was how to justify drafting enemy aliens out of a barbed wire prison camp. Their solution was as irrational and sloppily done as the internment itself. It was a loyalty questionnaire. A loyalty questionnaire after they took everything from us and imprisoned us for a year. And now they're demanding our loyalty. It was about 30 questions. Many of them were, most of them were pretty bland, but there were two questions that were key that they expected yes answers to. And the loyalty questionnaire had to be responded to by everyone over the age of 17 in all 10 camps, man or woman, 17 or an 87-year-old immigrant lady. The two critical questions. Question 27 asked, will you bear arms to defend the United States of America? This being asked of my parents. They were being asked to abandon their children and bear arms to defend the nation that's imprisoning their children. It was preposterous. My parents answered no. The next question, question 28, was even more insidious. It was one sentence with two conflicting ideas. It asked, will you swear your loyalty to the United States of America and forswear your loyalty to the Emperor of Japan? The Emperor of Japan, we're Americans. We never even thought of a loyalty to the Emperor. And for the government to assume that we had a pre-existing inborn racial loyalty to the Emperor was insulting. So if you answered no, meaning I don't have a loyalty to the Emperor to forswear, that no applied equally to the first part of the very same sentence. Will you swear your loyalty to the United States? If you wanted to say you're loyal to the United States and answered yes, meaning I am loyal to the United States, that yes applied to the second part meant that you were confessing that you had been loyal to the Emperor and now were prepared to forswear that loyalty to the Emperor and repledge your loyalty to the United States of America. It was insulting and it was enraging. And my parents answered no to that, to the second question as well. And for those two no's, they were now reclassified as disloyals. And all disloyals had to be put into a high security camp called a segregation camp for disloyals. And we were transferred from the Arkansas camp to the most symbolically evil camp called Tule Lake in Northern California, right by the Oregon border. Tule Lake was a cruel, harsh camp, and symbolically the most representative of the mentality of internment. Tule Lake was the most numerous, had the largest population. Most internment camps were anywhere from 6,000 to about 11,000. Tule Lake was 18,000 enraged people. It had not just one barbed wire fence, but two more layers, three layers of barbed wire fence, and a half a dozen tanks patrolling the perimeter. Actually, they were there to intimidate and goad these people. Those tanks belonged on a battlefield, not there to goad outraged Japanese Americans and intimidate them even more. At the time of the loyalty questionnaire, however, thousands of young Japanese Americans were so desperate to prove their Americanism, that they answered yes to those two offensive questions. And they went from behind those barbed wire fences to serve in the U.S. military. The women were put into the WACS, the Women's Army Corps. The men were put into a segregated, all Japanese American unit, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. They chose as their regimental motto, "Go for broke." They were determined to give it their all. They were sent to the battlefields of Europe so that they wouldn't be mixed up with the enemy, and literally used like cannon fodder, wave after wave of Japanese Americans. One gun down, the next wave went, but they fought with incredible courage and strength and dedication. Some were even heroic. The 442nd sustained the highest combat casualty rate of any unit of comparable size. And when the war ended, the 442nd returned to the United States as the most decorated unit of the entire war. They were welcomed back on the White House lawn by President Harry Truman, who said to them, "You fought not only the enemy, but prejudice, and you won." They were heroes of the Second World War. However, at the time of the loyalty questionnaire, there was another amazing group of young men who I consider equally heroic. They said, "I am an American and I will fight for my country, but I will fight as an American if I can report to my hometown draft board with my family back home. I would be like any American. I will have something to fight for. I will fight as an American, but I will not go as an internee, leaving my family in imprisonment, to put on the same uniform as that of the sentries guarding over my family. I will fight as an American." This was a gutsy stand, to take a stand against the full might of the United States government. But it was also a principled stand, and a very American stand, a true American stand. And for that, they were tried for draft evasion, found guilty, and transferred from an internment camp into Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary. But these men were fighters. They had a different battlefield. It was behind the tall concrete walls of a federal penitentiary, where they were insulted, harassed, and assaulted by the other convicts. But they stood strong. Many of them knew judo, and they proved to them how strong they were. They were proud Americans, and they ultimately got the respect of the other convicts there. The war ended, and as irrational as when we were rounded up, the gates of the prison camps were thrown open. We were free. Free to what? They had taken everything, stripped us of property, everything. The government gave us a one-way ticket to anywhere in the United States that we wanted to go to, and $25. We would start life all over with $25. My parents decided to go back to Los Angeles, but LA was not a welcoming place. Jobs were very difficult. Housing was impossible. Our first home was on Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles. And to us kids, and by that time I was 8 years old, the worst part of the internment was being freed. We had adjusted to the routine, the regimentation of imprisonment, but Skid Row was utter chaos. First of all, the stench of human excrements everywhere, on the streets, in the hallways, in the alleyways, everywhere. and scary, smelly, ugly people leaning on walls or staggering about or sprawled on the sidewalk. Women yelling and screaming and pulling each other's hair, and the chaos and the sounds, the shrieking sirens day and night. And at night, our hotel room would suddenly glow red with the light from the police cars. It was a chaotic, noisy, smelly place. My baby sister once said, "Mama, let's go back home." It wasn't the hotel that she was talking about. Home to her was behind barbed wire fence, because that's what she knew all her life, from infancy to being a four-year-old. It was a hellish place. And then we were there for about 3 months, and then we moved to the Mexican-American barrio of East Los Angeles, all Mexican-American. At school, all my friends were Mexican-Americans. I learned a little Spanish, and my mother learned how to cook Mexican from our neighbor, Mrs. Gonzalez. I had a teacher, however, who kept calling me the Jap boy, which stung, which hurt. She hated me, and I hated her right back, but I'll never forget Mrs. Rugen. We were there for 4 years. My parents worked day and night, killing hours, but they somehow saved enough money to buy a 3-bedroom, 2-bath home back in our old Wilshire District neighborhood. And there I became a teenager, and I became very curious about our childhood imprisonment. And so I became a voracious reader, read all the history books that I could get my hands on. Nothing about the internment in the history books of that time. The only person I could go to for information on my childhood was my father. And I was blessed by a father who did talk. Most Japanese American fathers did not talk about the internment with their children. My father did. As a matter of fact, he told me about our democracy. I gave my father a hard time because I was by that time reading civics books as well. And I knew some of the ideals of American democracy. I quoted to him Abraham Lincoln, "A government of the people, by the people, for the people." And he said, "That's precisely it. Our democracy is a government of the people. It's a people's democracy. And the people have the capacity to do great things, but people are also fallible human beings, and they make mistakes." He told me that President Roosevelt was a great president in the 30s when the United States was being crushed by a horrific depression. Millions of people without jobs and going hungry, lining up great long lines for a bowl of soup. But because President Roosevelt had the power of the presidency combined with his problem-solving capabilities and his political savvy, he was able to build roads, bridges, create jobs. He built post offices all over the United States. And he gave jobs to the people, the kind of people that lose their jobs the first. Artists. He hired artists for all the post offices and had them paint murals. And we still can enjoy those murals of the American worker. He created jobs up and down the wage scale and pulled the nation up from that depression. But when the country was swept up in war hysteria and racism because we looked different, we were at war with Germany and Italy, but Italian Americans and German Americans look like the rest of America. We were singled out because of race, despite the fact that we were Americans and imprisoned. And so he made a mistake. But a great president's mistake can be a great and devastating mistake for the minority that was victimized. And he said, because it's a people's democracy, it's a participatory democracy, we have to participate. And you've read about the ideals of American democracy in your civics books. It's not infallible, because it's the people that make it true and shining. We have to be in there to support those ideals. And he encouraged me to be active in student government. And one Sunday afternoon, he said, let me show you how democracy has to work. And he drove me downtown to the Adlai Stevenson for President campaign headquarters and introduced me to electoral politics. And there I was with all these other people passionately dedicated to getting this great governor of Illinois, an eloquent speaker, I heard his speeches on the radio, elected president, all passionately dedicated. And I was amongst them. I understood. And I after school, I was always going downtown to help out at the campaign headquarters, stuffing envelopes, making phone calls, leafletting on the sidewalk. I was introduced to electoral politics by my father. And since then, I've been active in electoral politics and social justice campaigns. I was involved in the civil rights campaign. I did a civil rights musical, and we were invited to sing at almost every civil rights rally in Los Angeles County. And at one of them, we had Dr. Martin Luther King as our keynote speaker. And that was a thrilling experience, marching with Dr. King and singing our hearts out. And after that rally, the cast of Fly Blackbird was invited to meet Dr. King. And I got a chance to shake his hand and share a few words with him. It was an incredible thrill. And this hand that shook his hand didn't get washed for about 3 days after that. And I later on, I became active in the peace campaign during the Vietnam War. And by that time, I was pursuing an acting career. So I joined the Hollywood peace movement called EIPJ, Entertainment Industry for Peace and Justice, and worked alongside people like Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland. And in the 70s, the movement began in the Japanese-American community to get an apology and redress for our unjust the Japanese-American incarceration. And I joined in that campaign. We went to Washington and lobbied congresspeople. And I testified at the Congressional Commission. And in 1988, President Ronald Reagan officially, on behalf of the United States government, apologized for that incarceration and signed the Civil Liberties Bill, which pledged a token redress of $20,000. When I eventually got my check, I donated that to the Japanese American National Museum, where I thought it belonged, because I was too young to really feel the pain personally. I was active in so many social justice causes and political campaigns, but I was pursuing an acting career. I had a TV series, Star Trek. I was working steadily every year for 3 years straight. And in 69, we were canceled. I was again unemployed. And that year, Stonewall happened, which galvanized the LGBT community, and the gay liberation movement began. But I was an unemployed actor. And if I were active in that campaign, I'd be jettisoning my acting career. An actor could not be hired at that time in the 1960s and in the 70s if it was known that he was gay. My heartthrob as a teenager was a blonde, athletic, good-looking actor named Tab Hunter. He was a star of every movie coming from Warner Brothers. I went to see every one of them. But when he was exposed as a gay actor, his career disappeared. So I knew I could not be active in that movement, the gay liberation movement, which was the most personal issue. I was gay, but I was closeted. I was silent on those issues because when I was about 10 years old, I had this growing realization that I'm different in ways other than my Japanese face. The other boys were saying things like, well, that we had a girl named Monica in our class in junior high school who was prematurely blossoming out in full womanhood. She was quite busty. And they'd say, wow, Monica's hot. I thought Monica's nice. They would say, Sally's sweet. She was all right. But Bobby, my heart went pitter-pat over Bobby. He had such a sweet smile and those long-lashed eyes. Or Richard, who was so athletic, and he was always taking his shirt off during recess. But the other boys didn't do that. And so I didn't want to be different. I was punished for being different as a child. And so I started pretending, acting like the other guys. And I said, yeah, Monica's hot. Oh, yeah. And when they started dating, I dated girls like everybody else. And when my buddy wanted to double date, I double dated. But to tell the truth, I was more interested in my buddy than in my date. I was living a fake life, a double life. And I didn't like being different again. There were a few boys that acted different. They were called sissies. They walked holding their book to their chest. And when they walked, they minced a little. And they were ridiculed and laughed at and teased. And I didn't want to be like that. They were just different. Those boys were different. Then I heard one of the other boys call them gay. And I thought, well, that's a strange word to call them. The sissies were rather shy and always intimidated and always looking sad. Well, what does that mean? But I learned that it was a word that meant boys who liked other boys, like me. And so I was determined not to be one of those that's teased and mocked and laughed at and sometimes attacked after school. And my father told me to be active in student government. And I eventually wound up being a student body president. And so that closeted me even more. And when I was pursuing an acting career, to protect my career had me even more tightly closeted. It was a torturous thing, not just the fear of being gay, but also the guilt, that constant guilt, and the fear of being exposed, that needle prick that you live with all day, every day, every day, throughout your closeted life. And I lived that life all my life, most of my adult life. When the AIDS plague hit, that was terrifying, because by that time, I had met other people that became friends who were gay, and I was introduced to gay bars. And there I felt I could really be myself, relax, put down the guard, and talk with the other guys in the gay bar about that Tab Hunter picture that we saw and that scene where he took his shirt off. I could be me and talk about what really made me excited. But one of the older guys told me, you have to be careful, even in a gay bar, because they raid gay bars and take the people out and pack them into paddy wagons, take them down to the police station, fingerprint them, which was terrifying, take their picture. It was really scary. Or your name put on a list. And if any of that was exposed, it would be devastating. You'd lose everything. Your job, your career, maybe your family. It was a horrible thing. And from there then on, I cut down on my visits to gay bars. And whenever I went, I stood near the rear entrance so that I could escape should it be raided. So I was closeted until during the AIDS epidemic. That made it even worse. The terror of, I mean, I was gay and friends were suddenly getting sick and drastically losing weight rapidly. And before long, they were literally skin and bone and gone. They were gone. It was terrifying. And I was still silent, but I talked with my checkbook. I made contributions to the cause. But the work that the other guys and gals were doing in the gay liberation movement was reaching people, fair-minded, decent, rational people who understood, and things started to change. And in 2003, Massachusetts got marriage equality from the state Supreme Court. And 2 years later, in my home state of California, this time the legislature, the people's representatives, passed marriage equality bill, the Senate and the Assembly. The nation would be bookended, Massachusetts and California. But the California bill needed one more signature, that of the governor, who happened to be a movie star, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was a Republican from the right wing of the party. And it was a kind of a chancy thing. I didn't have expectations. And sure enough, he vetoed it. And by this time I was together with Brad. We were at home watching the late night news. And when the veto issue came up, they cut to a shot of young people pouring out onto Santa Monica Boulevard, venting their rage against Arnold Schwarzenegger. And we felt the same rage, but we were at home watching a late night show, comfortable. And so we began a discussion, Brad and I did. We talked about it for many days, and finally we decided it's time. Time has come. And I spoke to the press for the first time as a gay man and blasted Schwarzenegger's veto. And we came out roaring then from that point on. We partnered with the Human Rights Campaign in Washington, D.C., and they arranged for a nationwide speaking tour from the East Coast to the West Coast. And we spoke at universities, corporate conferences, every opportunity that we got to speak on issue of equality for LGBT people. And we lobbied Congress and made speeches in Washington, and we campaigned. And in 2015, something extraordinary happened, extraordinary that we worked for and struggled for. The Supreme Court ruled for marriage equality throughout the land, from coast to coast, border to border. It was a thrilling, a huge event. Our spirits were 35,000 feet up in the air because Brad and I had a flight that day from New York to Los Angeles. And so we took our body to be together with our spirit, 35,000 feet up. And we toasted the Supreme Court ruling with airline champagne. And it was a celebration at 35,000 feet, where our spirits were too. And on that flight back, I looked out the window and I saw the Midwestern farms geometric patterns, the squares, the green squares, the brown rectangles, and some of them were circles because of the irrigation. But in about an hour or two, the rectangles and the geometric shapes disappeared, and it became a bland, flat, yellowish brown, the southwestern desert. But about an hour later, the western end of the desert started to wrinkle and crinkle and rise up to the majestic Rocky Mountains, and we descended into the valley of Los Angeles County. This was America, our America, and we were absolutely delighted. But that joyous day was 5 years ago. And yesterday morning, we got up with the same kind of joy. We turned on the TV set and it said, breaking news, the Supreme Court had acted again. And the ruling was written by the most unexpected person, a justice appointed by Donald Trump, Neil Gorsuch, the first appointment, Trump appointment to the Supreme Court. Equal protection under the law, now applied to gays, lesbians, bisexual, and trans people as well. It was another great step forward. It was an unbelievable American experience. I thought to myself, when I was a child, I was imprisoned behind American barbed wire fences. As an adult, throughout most of my adult, I was imprisoned by another invisible barbed wire fence, the fence of a closet. And this invisible barbed wire fence had barbs, invisible barbs, but as hard as steel and as sharp as that. Barbs of prejudice and discrimination. And I broke through those bars. This is a month of June. It's a celebratory month for not only LGBT people, but all fair-minded, decent people. In June of 1969, Stonewall began the movement. It galvanized the movement. In June of 2015, we got equality of marriage. And yesterday morning, we got equal protection under the law. It's a proud month. It's a proud month for gays, LGBT Americans. We are proud this month and all year long. This is going to last throughout our lives. I'm a Japanese American, and I am a proud Japanese American. And I will be that proud American all my life, because I have been able to participate in a participatory democracy. And most of all, and most definitively, I am a proud American. Thank you very much. Thank you.
I'm doing that on behalf of all of VMware, George. And I just want to say this Zoom call has over 3,000 attendees, and I've never seen that many, even when our CEO speaks. By the way, apologies, Pat, if you're listening to this.
Fantastic.
And we do have some time for questions. I'm going to try to grab some questions both from chat and from what people have asked before. Each question, by the way, starts with the same three comments. First of all, they all have all expressed outrage about what you went through as a child, and they thank you for sharing your story. Each question also says how big a fan that the person was. And you know, many of them have met you and said how welcoming you were. And all of them thank you for everything that you've done for the LGBTQ community. So I just wanted to say thank you. And just imagine that every question is prefaced with all of those. So let's get to the first one. The first one is, Entertainment Weekly recently included you in a portrait of LGBTQ plus icons for its Pride Month issue. And for those of you that haven't seen it, my wife happened to have a copy. It's right here. Here's our man, George.
A gold tuxedo jacket.
So the question is, who are the people you look up to as icons within the LGBTQ plus community?
Well, he isn't LGBTQ, but he spearheaded the efforts. When we returned from New York on that 2015 trip, and I was looking at America from 35,000 feet, I was thinking, the president of this vast, great land, this diverse land, is an African-American, President Barack Obama. And he has been at the spearhead of so much of making America closer to the ideals that we hold. So he's been a hero of mine, using the platform of the presidency, but his own personal passion and based on his own personal unique American experience, an African American, born in Hawaii, raised in Indonesia. I mean, how diverse is that? And then establishing a base in Chicago and becoming a state senator and then the US senator from the, it's an amazing, epic American story. From the LGBT community. Well, first of all, Japanese American story, a hero of mine, is another politician, a senator from the state of Hawaii. Hawaii was not a part of the United States when he was born. He wanted to be a doctor. He was studying to be medicine, but in Hawaii, they didn't have the internment either. It was only, I mean, it was so irrational, the internment, because it was Hawaii that was bombed. But the Japanese Americans of Hawaii were not imprisoned because there were too many of them. A third of the state was Japanese American. And if they were extracted from that society, the economy would have collapsed. No laborers, no consumers, no a third of the populace is gone. So the irony is, the place that was bombed that had the most Japanese Americans were not imprisoned. On the West Coast, where we were more spread out, and so our absence would not be as noticeable. But also there was greed. My maternal grandparents were in farming, and immigrants from Asia could not become naturalized citizens. My grandfather came from Japan, and he developed land that was considered wasteland into a productive part of the agribusiness of California. But he couldn't buy the land because he was from Japan. But his son, my uncle, was an American. And so he bought the land that he developed in his baby's name. My grandfather was a wily old guy. And so my uncle owned the land that my grandfather built and farmed until the war came. And another interesting sidebar, his neighbor was a German immigrant farmer, Mr. Kransarge. And they were very good friends. And so when internment came, he asked Mr. Kransarge to take care of his land, or actually his son's land. And he said, you can farm it and grow crops and sell it and you can keep the profit. But when we come back, we want the land back. And Mr. Kransarge was a good man and he returned the land when the war ended. I'm garrulous and I ramble.
Yeah, no way. You are a wonderful story.
Oh, yes. I was starting the story of Danny Noe from Hawaii. He and many young men like the mainland Japanese Americans after Pearl Harbor volunteered, and they were accepted into the military. And when people in the prison camps, Japanese Americans in the prison camps, were drafted, they were combined with the Hawaii people, and Danny Noe became one of the heroes that fought in Italy, France, and later in Germany. And in one of the Italian battles, he lost his right arm. And so he had a loose right arm. But after the war, he returned to Hawaii as a hero, and he was elected the first congressman to the House of Representatives to represent Hawaii. And he served two terms, and then he was elected to the Senate. And he served in the United States Senate for almost 50 years. He had the greatest seniority, and he was part of the Watergate hearings. And even a United States Senator at that hearing was referred to by one of the testifiers as that Jap guy sitting up there at the panel. I mean, the racism in this country was unbelievable. As a matter of fact, when Danny Noe was returning to Hawaii after the war, he stopped off in San Francisco, and since he's going to be landing in Hawaii, he wanted to look good when he got home. He went to a barbershop in San Francisco, and he was kicked out of that. He was wearing his uniform, U.S. Military uniform, but the barber said, "We don't cut Jap hair." And so he caught his plane and went back to Hawaii without that haircut. Even with the U.S. Army uniform on, he was insulted and refused a barbershop. So he's my Japanese American hero. And my gay hero are innumerable. I mean, I can't single out any one of them, but those soldiers who served with great honor and heroism and were kicked out and fought to get the military to do away with that don't ask, don't tell. Those who had the guts to campaign when I was still closeted, those are my heroes. And certainly the ones that became the not only the Stonewall people, but those that continue the effort and the human rights campaign are my heroes there.
I think you've highlighted so many important issues, and your story is so inspiring. I really want to thank you for your thoughtful answer to that question. And I think the next question is kind of a natural follow-on to many of the things that you've mentioned. I mean, obviously, you're familiar with what's happened in the U.S. following the police killing of George Floyd. And so one question from someone who wanted to refer to you quite appropriately as Admiral Takei was, do you draw parallels from your experiences during World War II with the Black Lives Movement of today?
How could I not? How could I not? But you know, with the Japanese Americans, it was a history of discrimination, legal discrimination, as well as overt insults. But with African Americans, it's a whole vast, long history, 401 years. And I was involved in the civil rights movement back in the 50s, and then in the 60s as well. Jim Crow was still there in my lifetime in the South. My father said that when we were coming back from Arkansas, he was confronted by the white bathroom and the colored bathroom. And he didn't know which want to go into. And he asked the white man, and he told him that he can go into the white one. But, you know, that kind of insult that the African Americans were subjected to, and the brutality with which Jim Crow is still kept alive with the police force. They're not law protectors of the community. You know, the LA police car says to protect and to serve. Well, many of the policemen are not protectors. They are the criminals. I mean, George Floyd was trying to pass what he thought was a $20 bill, which was apparently counterfeit. And that deserves the kind of treatment he got and to be killed. And with Rashard Brooks, the most recent one in Atlanta, Georgia. I mean, it's that kind of mindless brutality that still exists. He was running away. I mean, I'm told about 45 minutes of rational conversation. He was responding to the questions and taking all the tests, walking that line. Apparently he'd been drinking and he didn't prevail in those tests. But, you know, everyone drinks and you get stopped. But African Americans getting stopped, dark-skinned people getting stopped, is a whole different story altogether. And he was running away, shot in the back, because that's what law enforcement allows. And they've been happening for years. I remember, I knew a guy who was part of the Freedom Riders and sat in at the counter in North Carolina, in Charleston, North Carolina, I think. I'm not sure city, but I mean, you couldn't sit at a soda fountain and get a soda back in those days. From that to still today in the year 2020, that's happening. I would be out there marching in the Black Lives Matter demonstration, but I'm 83 and I am told that I'm in the vulnerable category. And I think it's better to be smart than have integrity that's endangering you.
I think that's very prudent, George. It's a tough decision for a lot of folks, and I think they really speak with their passion and their heart, just as you do. I wanted to close out this interview segment with a more lighthearted question. And by the way, I happened to buy this yesterday. I highly recommend it to everybody, but please buy it at your local bookstore. George's book, They Call This Enemy. My wife and I both read this last night. It's riveting, and it tells a lot of the stories that George didn't even have time to get through today. So the last short question, very lighthearted. When you were playing Commander Sulu, did you ever play him? Did you think of playing him as if he were gay, or how did you sort of approach that role?
That question comes up frequently. Gene Roddenberry created the series Star Trek. It premiered in 1965 for the first time. To get that show on the air back in 1965, no character, if he were gay, that show would not have sold. He created all the characters as straight characters because that was the time. And television was an advertising medium, and no advertiser would advertise on that show. When Star Trek VI, the motion picture, was being prepared, I got a phone call from John Cho, who's now playing my character, Sulu. And he said, for Star Trek VI, they want to pay tribute to me because of my activism on the LGBT equality movement. And so they're going to turn, they're talking of turning Sulu gay. And what do I think about that? And I told him, no, I don't think that's a good idea, because Gene Roddenberry created Star Trek, and the character of Sulu was straight. All the characters were straight. And besides, that movie would be coming out in 2016, which would be the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. And the tribute should be paid not to me, but to Gene Roddenberry, because it was his vision and his coining of that acronym IDIC, IDIC, Infinite Diversity in Infinite Combinations, which he meant to incorporate LGBT people without saying that. And so the tribute should be to Gene Roddenberry and keep Sulu straight as he created the character. But now that we live in a different time and that we can have gay characters as a member of Starfleet, be as creative and as original as Gene Roddenberry was, and create a new character who's gay and who would have had that gay experience throughout his life. What was it like to be a gay cadet with Starfleet? And what advantage was it sometimes? Because diversity has pluses and minuses. And what were the minuses of being gay in the 23rd century? But what are the unique qualities which made the Sulu character, a gay Sulu or a gay character, a contributor to the strength of the starship? So be original like Gene Roddenberry and create a gay character that has been gay all his life, rather than suggesting that Sulu had been closeted as George Takei was, and then coming out in Star Trek VI. And after that conversation, I got a call from the director, and I had another long conversation, and he kept saying, gotcha, I see, I understand. So I thought they were gonna create a new character. And so when the film came out, I went to see it, and it was such a disappointment. Sulu's coming back from a mission, and there's a guy carrying a little girl in his arm, and Sulu goes straight for that little girl and grabs her and hugs her and kisses her. And in the next shot, the two guys are walking away with Sulu carrying the girl. The guy could have been his brother or a friend with his daughter. That was it. I mean, what a disappointment. I would like to see, and they're doing it right now with the Star Trek Discovery. You know, they have a gay character living together in the same quarters, and they've had a whole life as a gay person who joins Starfleet and earned their way into Starfleet as a gay person, as well as Latino or as well as a white, and contributing to the mission, boldly going where no one has gone before.
You know, George, as usual with every answer, you've made me think of 100 other questions I'd like to ask and that the VMware would like to ask, but unfortunately, I don't have time. But I can think of no more fitting way to end this interview segment than by saying, thank you so much from the VMware community, and live long and prosper. Thank you. We so deeply appreciate the time that you spend with us. Thank you.
Live long and prosper to everyone. Live long and prosper.